so much for the opportunity to speak here. It's always a pleasure for us to be invited to such an event because it allows us to tell the story of the Congo then and now. So I won't really spend any time talking about myself and how I came to be here. Suffice to say that in 1991, I traveled from the Congo to the UK to seek asylum. And thankfully, I was granted asylum and I've been here ever since. I have a family. My wife and I, we have two boys and we found a life here. But obviously, events back home in the Congo always draw us into wanting to talk about it and spreading the news about the Congo. Because if we look back into history, we will, at least Congolese history, we will come to understand that there has always been an attempt to silence whatever is happening in the Congo. And whenever the world comes to learn about what goes in the Congo, there's always been some kind of reform. And that's what I'll be attempting to tell you about today. The first thing really to remember about the Congo, at least the state of the Congo, is that when it is formed, it's actually formed as an enterprise by the Belgian King Leopold II. And the key date really, or the key year, is 1885, when he then gets really the approval of other states at the Berlin Conference that he is actually the sole owner of the Congo. He effectively becomes the landowner of the Congo and everything that is in it, including people and animals. And that's what actually gives him effective control of the Congo. And it's important to distinguish between the state of Belgium and King Leopold II as a king of the Congo. And what he does is interesting because he sets out, or at least tells the world, that he is on a humanitarian mission. He's actually going to the Congo to ensure that there is no slavery and that this dark area, at least from a Eurocentric point of view, this dark area, the heart of darkness, he's going to go there in his mission to civilize the people of the Congo. And that's how he presented the world. It's a very effective PR machine that he actually put in motion to be able to create that sense of a European savior going into the Congo. At the beginning, obviously, this area is very large and we have disparate ethnic groups. So we're not having one ethnic group in that area. We have the Congo, we have the Luba, we have the Ngala, and we have all sorts of other people being pushed together to form this new state without any kind of consent from the people who are being organized in this new state. And one of the key features, really, of this enterprise, the formation of the state of the Congo, is the use of brute violence. You know, you are not consulted, there is no kind of engagement with the locals to actually engage them in the process of forming a new state. You are imposed, you're actually non-existent, your voice it's not even taken into account. And not only brute violence, but also humiliation. And I'm sure many of the artifacts do actually testify to that. So at the beginning, really, because of the PR machine, even the missionaries who wants to go into their evangelical mission, they actually feel that actually it is justified to cooperate with the Belgian King because he's going to civilize the heathens of Africa. So I've already alluded to the PR machine, but even within the Congo itself, you can't just rely on brute violence. You also have to use other effective mechanism to actually keep people enslaved. So he used effectively Christianity to actually impose it on people. It was not conversion, it was, if you really wanted to have any kind of emerging public service that was coming with colonization, you really had to kind of show a willingness to embrace this venture, because whatever this emerging state was doing was actually being done effectively through the missionaries. And the missionaries were also helping the state to form, because what they were doing, as in the case, for instance, of George Grenfell, he would actually help the Belgian king to map out what his new territory is, and he would go to places that many explorers were not able to reach. So for many missionaries, they were establishing stations, but those stations were not just places where evangelization can take place, but also were places where commerce could take place, and where also some form of education was taking place. And much of it also was also through catechism, how people could learn about this new religion. Now, it's really difficult for me, given the scope of the subject we're talking about, to give you a timeline in a way that actually would make sense to you. But suffice it to say that the key feature of using brute force has actually been used throughout the existence of Congo, even as it became independent, but also the propaganda machine that was always used to force state policies has continued to be used, obviously with changes in the way that was carried. For instance, when Mobutu takes power in 1965, he also doesn't necessarily have that popular consent, and he has to find a way not only to use brute force, but also a way to charm people. And interestingly, what he does is very clever, because he uses a very nationalistic rhetoric, which actually appeals to people, because they have gone through colonization. So they have suffered through colonization, and they really hate colonization. So he is using that actually to let people actually, I'm the African king, more or less, that you actually should be having. And he also uses our own tradition, a way of life, or at least what, you know, he portrayed to the people to be the way of life as what he wanted Congo to be. So he uses authenticity as one of his propaganda ideology. So the return to ancestral values. So he used that effectively, but whilst he's doing that, his power is actually very much interconnected with the Cold War strategy of making sure that you had friendly dictators. And he actually was very effective in terms of making sure that Western interests within the Congo and the region were pursued in a way that satisfied that agenda. So we're talking about at the beginning of the state, we're talking about rubber. Now, the exploitation of rubber in the Congo was really what killed that many people in the Congo. So the Belgian king, for him, Congo represented an economic opportunity, not only for him, but also for his country. Although the management of the country was really, it was actually his own private rule with the people that he had invited to form that ruling class for the Congo. Initially, it was obviously ivory, because rubber had not been discovered, at least to be used in tires. So with the discovery of rubber tires, and that can be used in bicycles and in the new market of cars, that became such an important asset to have. And effectively, what King Leopold II mandated was that everyone had to reach a certain quota. And if you did not reach that quota, then you were beaten up, many were mutilated because they were not able to reach the quota that the king had set. And it also happened that many Congolese were forced to just keep going in terms of finding the rubber for the new state. Something else that also happened was that a lot of wives and children were being taken hostage, so that if you were a husband, you would be forced to go and make sure that you collected the rubber that was important to the state and then bring it over. And you did not always get your wife back. And there were always stories of rape and of really mistreating those who were in hostage. So everyone was really held ransom to this new state. But whilst all this is happening, the state obviously continued to take hold. You know, there is further recognition that actually, yes, this is a territory, this is a new territory. Interestingly, the state is actually called from 1885 to 1908, Congo Free State. And that's really important to remember, because King Leopold II rules over a country that is not powerful enough in world politics. So he has to find a way to appease those who may start to become jealous of what he is able to offer. So actually free is actually what people were able to come into the Congo and do commerce. And if you were also missionaries, you were able to go, and the state in some way also enabled you to do your evangelization. But things started to change because of the fact that there started to be some kind of rivalry between Britain and Belgium, in the sense that, yes, the missionaries are coming, but also Belgium is, or at least King Leopold II, becomes suspicious of British interest, how they can pursue those interests. And at the beginning, actually, Britain felt that they had been outmaneuvered, because there was already another explorer, Rhodes, who was actually making sure that Britain would be able to colonize effectively from Southern Africa all the way to Cairo, and that was the project. But because of Stanley and King Leopold II's ability to use diplomacy and lobbying very effectively, in 1884, the US was the first country to actually recognize Congo Free State. So you had a powerful country actually already recognizing a state. So in a way, when they went to the Berlin Conference, almost everything had already been done. So Britain had no choice but to accept the inevitable. So in a sense, King Leopold II feels threatened by British interests within the Congo. In fact, in order to help you understand how influential the English were within the Congo in that time, a lot was also happening in English. So you had some literature about that. So you have some translation, early translation into local languages, and you even have a dictionary which is in Lingala English. Of course, it was not just for commerce and for colonial pursuit, but it was also because of missionary work. So one has to be able to understand the complexity of what is being at play here. So just like then, the natural resources work funded the ruling elite, King Leopold II and all his cronies, but also the new transnational companies that were coming into the Congo for commerce. Just like then, today the same thing is happening. So the ruling elite within the Congo have almost effectively replaced what King Leopold II was doing back then. So they're using the money from our natural resources for their own personal gain. But also, many transnational companies are also profiting from it. So that has repeated itself from the Leopoldian state to the Belgian state and to Mobutu's era, who came into power in 1965 and ruled as a dictator till 1996. And after his overthrow, the new successive government have also done literally the same. So there is a pattern that has actually repeated itself, where money from the natural resources have really benefited the ruling elite, but also outside interest. Now, silence, as I was saying, was always an important factor here, making sure that what is happening, the atrocities, what happens in the Congo stays in the Congo. And in the West, obviously, there is the story of really all the missionaries going there and everything going fine. Now, at the beginning, King Leopold II allows all the missionaries to continue to work side by side, Catholics, Protestants, it didn't really matter. But as things continue, especially the Protestant missionaries start to get very uneasy about this. and they start to question their own involvement and whatever role they may be playing here. And it becomes also very important for King Leopold II to secure the approval of the Vatican to make sure that actually the missionaries that come to Congo would actually be mostly Belgian. So now mission work for Congo effectively is done by Belgian Catholics, for the Catholics. And there is also another reason why this is the case, why King Leopold II feels that it's best if it's done through the Belgian Catholics. One of the reasons is because from the 15th century to, say, about the 17th century, we had an interesting period where actually Christianity was absorbed within the Congo Kingdom, at least. And actually, it didn't really have that many problems because the way that evangelization took place was very similar to how evangelization took place within Europe, in the sense that there was actually genuine conversion. There was actually times when actually you had tension between Portugal and the Congo Kingdom, where even the ruling class still felt the need to want to maintain their Christianity, and they were very proud of their Christianity. So he didn't want that kind of evangelization taking place within the Congo. So when the Protestants started to raise their concern about what was happening, then by that time it's also late, but also because many of those missionaries started to really protest. And the case of Grenfell, he even gave back the medal that he was given by King Leopold II, because he felt at some point that he had actually contributed to what King Leopold II had actually done within the Congo, and he was appalled by it. But at the same time as well, in terms of silence, and this is really important, especially in our context, the network that the missionaries had also created allowed them to also compile reports that were then published within Europe. An important report was by Roger Casement, who was the British consul within the Congo, who compiled an incredible, effective report which he submitted to the British government, and that allowed the British government to then really disassociate itself with what was going on within the Congo. Back then, he became a hero because of the quality of his report. But there were also people like Morel, who played a significant role in terms of actually popularizing the story of the Congo and making it accessible to the middle class back then. There were also people within the US who became very interested in actually making sure that change was going to take place. So King Leopold II had no option but really to reform and to change the rule, his rule within the Congo. And as a way of making sure that no other powerful country takes over Congo, he gave it up to Belgium. In fact, the country that he promised Congo if anything was to happen to him was actually France, but he did it so rapidly that Belgium took over. In fact, France in 1960, when Congo became independent, had to renounce its entitlement to have the Congo. So that was part of our independence process. So everybody who had any claim on Congo had to renounce, and France was one of such states. So there is that Congo reform movement that is really effective and leads to that reform taking place. So we then have a breather within the Congo because things start to improve, and because they have improved, we are able to have some reforming the education system. We start to have large-scale primary schools and secondary schools being built. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily have universities, but we get them eventually around the late 40s, early 50s, universities start to be built. And as a result, when Congo become independent, we really don't have that many university graduates, which even for that time was, in comparison to other countries, it was really the worst you could have. So we were really unprepared in terms of many skills that a state needs in order to function. And really the result will show when we become independent in the 1960s. There is also a lot of misunderstanding about global politics and how it functions and all those things. story, in a way, is being retold. It's repeating itself. So when Rwanda goes through a terrible time of genocide in 1994, and the then Rwandan army, which committed a lot of atrocities within Rwanda, and much of them escape into Congo. When Rwanda starts to reestablish itself, it wants to pursue them because they pose a security threat for their existence. And it also coincides when Mobutu's reign within the Congo is disintegrating, and it means his hold of the Congo very much weakened. His army, he himself actually ensures that the army is not powerful enough so that no one within the army attempts to overthrow him, but also that weakens his army in order to actually prevent any kind of external invasion. And Rwanda goes into Congo quite easily in 1996, using a wide variety of former rebel groups and rebel leaders who then effectively take power in the Congo. But Rwanda continues to exert a lot of influence within the Congo. And Mobutu, who had been in power from 1965, is overthrown eventually in 1997. They have a puppet government in the Congo, headed by Laurent Kabila. And he starts to build his own confidence in his ability to rule the Congo. In 1998, he effectively, ceremoniously, asks them to leave. But they leave, but they don't really leave, because they then start to have proxy armies, especially in the eastern part of the Congo. And they're pursuing, this time, not only security interests, but also economic interests. And that, in a sense, really gets you to a repetition of what took place in the Congo Free State, or what was called the Congo Free State when King Leopold II was the ruler, repeats itself in some form within eastern Congo. And in eastern Congo, you have a strong presence of the Rwandan state, pulling strings for a lot of rebel groups that are in the Congo. And many times the international community would intervene in terms of asking Rwanda not to do so, but that has continued to be the case. Now, what actually has happened within the Congo has actually been quite interesting, in the sense that you have had some patterns that have actually run through. It's like some kind of thread that has run through our history. So we have had mostly really militaristic regimes, and even our style of leadership has been very much influenced by the military. And you've had strong men leading the country. Really, if you were to use it as a loose analogy, you would actually say that you can actually see how Mobutu is very similar to King Leopold II, and you see how Mobutu is similar to Laurent Kabila, and even for the current president, Joseph Kabila. So that has been the pattern of the Congo. Another pattern of the Congo has been the use of forced labor. When things are really terrible, and when there is a semblance of peace within the Congo, then you have cheap labor. So effectively, you have either cheap labor, really cheap labor, or you have forced labor. And at the moment in eastern Congo, that's forced labor. And as a result of all the armed conflict within eastern Congo and other parts of the Congo, we have had over 5 million people who have died on a massive scale. Yes, many not really through open war, but also through diseases, through lack of access to healthcare. And we have also had the use of rape as a weapon of war. So armed groups who have rebelled against the government, and even those who were used as proxy armies by neighboring countries, have used rape as a weapon of war to a massive scale. So it even goes beyond what Leopold II did, which was already horrific. So this time, not just mutilating you, but if you are a woman, they want to make sure that your reproductive organs are destroyed completely. So they're not just raping you, but they're really making sure that you are destroyed. Now, we're talking about, in the case of Eastern Congo, since 1998, we're talking about four minerals that have been the minerals of choice for rebel groups in Eastern Congo. And those minerals, just like when rubber tires were discovered, they were really important for technological advancement. The same thing is happening now with those four minerals that are really crucial for our modern day technology. And they're being used by armed groups to finance their activities. So just like King Leopold II financed his colonial endeavor in Congo, the armed groups are also financing their own war efforts through those minerals. And they're essentially tin, tungsten, tantalum, and gold. And they're really important. And maybe just to give you a little idea of why they're important, with tantalum, it's a good anti-corrosive, so you can use it in your mobile phone, for instance. It's a good heat conductor. It doesn't actually heat up quite easily. And that's why in the old days we used to have bulky telephone. Now we have very small devices because of minerals like tantalum. And then tin, obviously, is used as a solder. And tungsten is used, you know, that vibrating device that we have in mobile phones so that it can vibrate. It's often used for that. And gold is, as always, is a good conductor as well. So all those minerals are really important in our modern day technology. Just like rubber was important back then, now those minerals are really important. And there is not much awareness around that. Now, how has the world responded? Well, the movement that we've all been part of in terms of making sure that the world is told about what is taking place in the Congo, but also the role that the world is playing in that, that story has not been told as effectively as the story that Morel or Casement told. You don't have renowned writers necessarily talking about the Congo in the way, say, Mark Twain talked about the Congo. Even Mark Twain could talk about the Congo. So you actually wonder, you know, I know many people would look at what took place then in terms of colonial enterprise and would say probably that I wouldn't want to live in such an era. But the question is really, it's still happening, but why are people not being repulsed by it? Why are all those, because then there were also a lot of benefactors that made sure that this story of the Congo was told. But now you have some kind of apathy, and you actually wonder whether we actually live in an age of moral bankruptcy, because such a story is actually happening now, and actually it's a challenge to all of us to question ourselves how we haven't done what we're supposed to do. Now, having said that, there have been some changes, and some of those changes have been brought about by some the introduction of the Dodd-Frank Act in the US in 2010. It was resisted, obviously. A lot of technology companies said that actually it was not useful. In fact, it was going to do the reverse. It was not going to help people on the ground. And only them could say things like, actually, it's going to destroy employment in the Congo. And, you know, I've traveled in the Congo. I'm from the Congo. I have family there. Many of us perceive the argument of the employment, destroying employment in Eastern Congo as really a fallacy. It doesn't stand any scrutiny because what is happening there is forced labor. And what we don't want to take place is really that all those transnationals that are making a lot of money and taking the minerals really for very little money out of it, and destruction it's causing not only to people but to the environment. Most Congolese would say that we want that to stop, and one of the ways to stop that is really through the legal process, to make sure that those who are complicit to that, you know, are stopped by law, and that also the armed groups don't continue to benefit from it. So the Dodd-Frank ensured that, or at least mandates that technology companies have to be transparent with how they are sourcing their minerals from the Congo, and they have to show that they have a risk assessment in order to make sure that they're not allowing into the supply chains minerals that have benefited armed groups. So we have effectively a tale of two cities where you're starting to get a market which is cleaner, where people are ensuring that miners, in the case of Eastern Congo, we're talking about mostly artisanal miners, small-scale miners. So we are having a tale of two cities in the sense that you're having people who are treated fairly and are able to conduct their mining activities without being forced to do so. And then another tale, which is that armed groups are continuing to benefit from it, especially through smuggling in neighboring countries again, and then exporting it to countries where you have smelting companies, for instance, in places like China, where really human rights are not always part of their agenda, even though they're starting to change. I have to say, China is also starting to come up with its own set of guidance and policies around that, which is a good thing. Now, I'm in my last point, and it has to do with our own work with Congo Calling, which is really ensuring that we are able to mobilize citizens, but also consumers. We are able to ensure that they get the right information, that they know what is happening with the Congo, but also they start to pressurize the politicians to ensure that we come up with policies as a country, that we come up with policies that ensure that there is no conflict minerals in our supply chains. We also lobbying public bodies like local councils, asking them to pass motions and to even commit at their level that when they buy technology, that they will be favoring companies that are improving their supply chains. The same thing is also happening with universities. And in terms of universities, a lot of universities across the UK have already taken up that challenge. They're forming their own groups to raise awareness around their peers, but also to lobby officials within their universities so that they can have a policy in place that says that when they have a choice between a company that is totally disregarding improvement in their supply chains and another that is actually doing that, that they would go for the one that has made improvement. Now, obviously, within reason, because it's not the only factor, we understand that, because sometimes it has to do with money, how much they're offering and so on. But often, actually, it's almost at the same level. So if you can choose between two companies, choose the one that has made some improvement. And the same thing goes with us encouraging people to write to their technology providers. And a lot of people actually have a lot of influence when it comes to technology companies, because maybe they've placed some money, and others who manage pension funds, they have the ability to ask them even those little simple questions. Once a lot of people ask those questions, then change starts to happen. You can also consider to donate to Congo Calling, which is a charity. You can also consider to give your time and many other things. Now, if you have a mobile, then the littlest thing you can do is to follow us on Twitter, but not just follow us, but also tweet about what we do and why it is important to ensure that we bring about peace in the Congo, but also that the mineral wealth start to benefit the local people. Thank you. We'll be right back.